The interesting thing about self-promotion is that there's lots of ways that you can get misjudged, mislabeled, misunderstood so easily, especially when you're being interpreted through so many other lenses on the internet. But I do think that you used the word before, it's consistency and clarity. You've got to know what it is that does set you apart, right? Just trying to be noticed isn't helpful, right? Getting watched versus getting seen shouldn't be the goal, right? You have to be seen and known and understood, which means you have to be real clear about what are the insights, what's the contribution you can make that others really want. And so matching a real clear sense of what you want to contribute with a set of people you know need it, and being really diligent about keeping on that plumb line and not deviating from it. Too many people flit between fad du jour or the content du jour or the idea du jour, and then they have a lot of stuff out there, but people still can't tell who it is you are, what you stand for. Consistency and clarity.
This is the Inno the Buzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 106 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses committed to innovation, to service and modern marketing become even more innovative. Now, before I introduce today's guest, just a quick announcement. If you want more information on marketing in today's world and some great articles and insights that our group put together and share, then please join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. It's no cost to join. Lots of great information there. Just go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. That's innovabiz.co/TMAC. I hope to see you there soon. And when you first join, do introduce yourself to the group so we all know who you are and what you need. In today's interview, we talk to Ron Carucci, the co-founder and managing partner at Navalent. Ron is a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review and to Forbes. He's a TED speaker and he's the best-selling author of 8 books. Navalent work with CEOs and executives pursuing transformational change, which is something that really excites me. And they work with some really impressive clients that include Microsoft, Citibank, Starbucks, McDonald's, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Johnson & Johnson, and even the CIA, which intrigued me. Now, there's probably many more clients. We talk with Ron about the challenges of strategy, of organization, and of leadership, the key attributes of a great leader, including the mindset of leadership, and also about the irrelevance of the year you were born to what you will contribute. So without further ado, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Ron Carucci. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today Ron Carucci, who's the co-founder and managing partner of Navalent. He's a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review and Forbes. He's a TED speaker and a best-selling author of 8 books. So welcome to the podcast, Ron, all the way from Seattle, I believe.
Jürgen, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's a privilege to have you here. Now, Navalent works with CEOs and executives, particularly in the area of transformational change for their organizations, for their leaders, for their industries. So I'm really excited about that. I'm a fan of transformational change and always delight in seeing how to address that challenge well. Your list of clients is really impressive. They include Microsoft, Citibank, Starbucks, McDonald's, a lot of companies that people would be well familiar with, and of course PricewaterhouseCoopers, Johnson & Johnson, and even CIA, which I was quite intrigued by. Just to name a few, there's a whole lot more, of course. And you've got an endless passion and a 30-year track record of helping executives tackle those challenges of change, of strategy, of organization and leadership. So I'm really looking forward to our discussion today.
Jürgen, I am too. Let's dig in.
Yeah. All right. Now, before we start talking about leadership and innovation, let's find out more about your journey so far. So as a young child, did you have visions of doing this when you grew up?
Well, I don't, you know, I think if you look back, you know, isn't hindsight always 2020? I think I think I did always have a passion for organizing human endeavor. You know, I was the kid who wanted to organize the stickball game or the kickball game or organize the local fundraiser. So, you know, bringing people together in common endeavor, that was always fun for me. I always was excited about what it was teams of people or groups of people could accomplish in big scale, whether it was a big school event or a big fundraising trip or a big field trip. I was always the one that wanted to push the envelope and try things with others that hadn't been tried. So if that was foreshadowing to the career I have, then so be it. I don't know that I could have known that this was a career. I began my early professional career in the arts didn't have glimmers of doing the work I do now till, you know, in my early 20s, I was working in Europe with a nonprofit firm that focused on multiple media and arts. We had a contract with the U.S. military and State Department, and we were in Germany the concentration camp, Dachau, visiting, and we were in the chapel of all places. And I think the term diversity and inclusion didn't exist then, but I think that's what this workshop would have been called. It was about managing differences. We were presenting some creative artistic material and story material about that. We had East Germans and West Germans and Americans and civilians and military folks in the room all together in this conversation. And at one point, a young soldier, an American soldier, probably not much older than me, raised his hand and in a very vulnerable emotional expression said, I'm just so tired of being trained to hate. And my first reaction was, well, I can't believe something we did up here made him think that. But then as we pressed into the conversation and heard more about what he was thinking and what the material we presented had made him reflect on, I just wanted to know more. So afterwards, you know, you're in Munich, so you go out for a beer. And we spent into the very late hours of the night just talking. And I think that for me was a turning point of understanding that, you know, telling great stories was interesting to do, but entering other people's stories and helping them rewrite their own stories or entering communities of people to help them architect a story, that was far more fascinating to me. That was far more energizing to me and probably far less boring.
But more variety, right?
Yeah, you know, I think my friends, when I get great jobs in New York, they'd be really envious. And I think to myself, I have to do the same thing 8 times a week for how many weeks?
Yeah.
And so I think that would have been the real turning point where my passion for human endeavor and organizing people's work and helping create clarity and passion about what people did and helping them do it to their best ability was probably first birthed.
It's a fascinating story. So tell us a little bit more then about Navalent and what you do there.
Yeah, so we get to spend our days, we're 13 years old now, so we hardly get to use the term startup anymore. But we spend our days traipsing the hallways of small startup and mid-size and large companies alongside leaders who've been tasked with some massive change. You know, maybe it's that they have to launch a new product, or they have to deliver different results or capabilities, or there's a major disruption technologically they have to respond to, or they have to change the culture because it's not responding the way they need it to. Some mandate either that they're imposing or that's being imposed on them for substantial systemic change, where a nip and tuck to the org chart's not going to work, or changing out a leader or two won't get it done. And so we come alongside them to help construct a plan for how to get that change done, for how to, you know, think about strategy and organization and culture and process and governance and all the different pieces and parts that go into making change stick. And we help them, you know, not only conceive that journey, but actually go on it with them and make sure they get to the results they're looking for.
So it's very much a relationship type arrangement as opposed to the old style corporate consultant comes in and dumps a lot of information and then leaves again.
We're absolutely not that guy.
Yeah.
That guy and those navy blue binders get us a lot of aftermarket business. We get to go follow them around and clean up the messes. But we are absolutely based in a very intimate relationship with our clients, which sometimes our sales cycles can be multiple years because it takes that long to both de-risk the kind of intimate relationship we have relative to the major requirements of change they're facing. And sometimes it's just not the right time. And so we build those relationships over long periods of time. And when the meter starts running, the meter starts running. But, you know, our philosophy is help and consult first, sell later. That's why I think our relationships have gone on for so long with so many clients, because when they leave and go to other companies, they take us with them.
Yeah. And I think that model works really well, doesn't it? I'm fascinated because a lot of people aspire to that kind of model, but they get frustrated because of what you said, the sales cycle being so long, particularly if they're in the startup phase and they're experiencing the ups and downs of, you know, one project is finishing and then they haven't had time to do marketing and sales, and then all of a sudden they don't have work and the cycle keeps repeating.
It is a very volatile, it's not for the faint of heart, Jürgen, right? Because you get tempted to just start selling products and to commoditize yourself. And you know, no one's going to go on your website and see, you know, $1 million transformation, click add to cart, right? how do you have enough of a pipeline, enough of a set of relationships, you know, grow your field of influence and your credibility and your thought leadership and all the ways those kinds of leaders would find you, so that, in fact, when you need to continue to replenish your client portfolio or, you know, add more to it, they're there. And I can tell you at Navalent, it's a new muscle for, I mean, we're 13 years old, but we're still learning how to do that. It is very difficult. And so, you know, for some, having counter-cyclical businesses and other types of digital content or other types of offerings that allow you to be impacting and helpful, but in other ways, you know, that to offset your portfolio is a way to do it. I mean, that the challenge there is, how do you blend the right balance of a digital footprint versus a personal footprint? But there are ways to balance the portfolio. But if you're going to be committed to good, deep, intimate relationships, it's hard to fake that. And sometimes being the smartest kid in the class and looking like you're the smartest kid in the class isn't necessarily the way to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I was doing a lot of work recently about getting clear about who your ideal client is, and it comes up everywhere, whether it's in a business thing or whether it's doing presentations where you're concerned about your audience and so on. And I read something this morning that I thought, well, that is captures it really well, which is, it's not about you, and the... your customer is the hero of the story, and you might have a bit part, but that's about it.
Yep. And I think the reality is it's very hard for some consultants to play that role in the wings, right? But we should be not seen and heard. We should play a role in the wings, and our job is to make them successful and make their voice amplified and make their influence more credible and effective. And the fewer people that know we were there doing it, the better, the more successful they'll be.
Yeah, that's great advice. Now, you're a very prolific publisher. I mentioned that you have 8 books, and maybe I'm out of date, or maybe there's more in the works. You're also a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review and to Forbes. You've got TED Talks. You've got various other videos online and so on. How important is all that content to your marketing effort?
Well, it's extremely important. I wish I had been more intentional about it many years ago. about over 2 years ago, I actually hired a coach to help me sort all that out, because I thought I was doing the things I needed to do to attract the kinds of clients I wanted to work with. But I seem to be just attracting sociopaths, and they can be exhausting. I mean, somebody should help. Somebody should help them. I didn't want it to be me anymore. I'm even happy to have people in my firm do it. I just don't want to wake up in the morning and dread who it is I'm going to be seeing that day.
But as it turns out,
I not only did I not know what to do to attract the right kinds of clients, I wasn't even in the right galaxy. And so, you know, better late than never, I got some great support and help to learn about what it means to use content marketing, to use content, to use, you know, thought leadership as a way to step away and set apart from many, many other people out there doing this work. And I think that's part of what made us a little bit fall behind at Navalent. You know, we've been so fortunate to have many great clients refer us and or travel to other companies and take us with them, that our efforts, we never felt the need to really be diligent about this till about 5 years ago. And the problem was in the 10 years since we had all begun, or 15 years since we'd begun our careers as consultants, even before Navalent, the volume of people working in this space, I mean, it's 100x what it used to be. There are, you know, thousands of small boutique firms using the same language we use. There are hundreds of thousands of individual practitioners, you know, claiming to do this work. And it was no longer the anomaly, unique, odd thing to do organizational work. And so we were a little bit behind in having and are working very diligently now to catch up and continue to, you know, refresh the breadth of our voice and help people continue to see the value we can create and have an experience of us before they even know us, because the marketplace is just that much more crowded now. And so it plays a vital role, but it's not just generating content. It's knowing what content to generate and knowing how to use it, knowing where to place it, and knowing how to, you know, broaden your echo chamber and amplify, you know, what it is you're saying to the right places. And boy, none of that's sure easy. It really is a difficult, complicated thing. One of my colleagues in our firm, his expression about the internet is that the internet is just a lawless place of dumb. And you just don't ever know what you're going to get. And so, you know, it takes a lot of effort. You can't dabble in it. You really have to put a lot of intentional and thoughtful effort into managing your digital footprint and your digital voice.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I mean, it was a bit of a Dorothy Dix question, because I'm a firm believer in, you know, positioning for authority and so on. In fact, just this week, I was totally devastated, because back in my corporate career, one of the first things I did in the very early days of the internet was be involved in a small project that ended up being an authority website that had basically over 30 years, over 3 years, it totally transformed the market we were in and put us in a dominant market leadership position and you know, taught me about the principles of how you can use this, what was then quite a new medium, to provide information and educate your audience in a way that they then understand what you're doing, and you know, if it's the right audience, they'll actually see you as the authority and the person to come and buy things from. So it was recently shut down by the company that acquired a company that I work for, so after 30 years, and it was still, you know, probably the without a doubt, it was the number one visited site for that particular niche in the world. So I couldn't understand that decision, but I was out of it anyway. So, but it really is so important. And like you say, it's important to be strategic. The other thing is consistency, isn't it? Which, you know, you've definitely been really consistent and prolific.
Well, it's not easy. As you know, it's you have to be consistent. You have to be diligent. You know, you've had Dory Clocker on your show. Many of the disciplines that are required to do this, and then there's the sticking to it, right? You can't just dabble in it and then leave. You have to be willing to not die on Heartbreak Hill when everybody else has given up. Right? You know, we all know that there's 400,000 podcasts out there, but if you dig a little deeper, you also know that the research suggests that they all average about, you know, 10, 11 episodes. And so if you just want to stick it out and build your following, you actually can use you know, mediums like podcasting as a way to really differentiate.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. We, a little while ago, we hit episode 100, which essentially for us is 2 years of regular podcasting. And it's quite amazing how all of a sudden the number of inquiries we were getting about coming onto the podcast and about connecting me with other guests potentially started going up quite dramatically. And I think it's what you say, probably. It's, you know, people see you've reached 100. Well, obviously you're in this for the long haul.
Yep. Well, and then they look at your guests and they become subscribers and they become active listeners, and that your echo chamber is larger, right? So that you feel like you're not just blowing your own smoke.
That's right. Yeah.
But it really does take, I mean, you've done it, so you know, it's an enormous amount of work.
Mm. Yes, it definitely is, but I thoroughly enjoy it. So it's not, it doesn't feel like work. Anyway, the one thing I looked at when I was doing my research was your video on how to, or basically build your own power. I can't remember the exact title of it, but it was about, you know, you're a lot more powerful than you give yourself credit for. So I think we often feel as though we don't have the influence that we desire or crave, or we can't influence other people. So talk to us a little bit about that and some of the strategies you mentioned there. I mean, we'll definitely have links to that in the show notes, but interested in exploring that.
Yeah, that was one of my most recent TED events, and it was based on our 10 year study on failed leadership transitions. And one of the dimensions we studied was power, assuming that leaders, you know, rising up and failing, which we've known for 20 years is about half of those appointed to broader assignments fail within their first 18 months. And we assumed that, in isolating the dimension of power, what we would find is, and of course, our headlines these days just can't get enough of telling us the latest person who indulged their power for selfish or immoral or self-interested gain. And certainly those examples were in the data. But what was probably the most surprising finding in the data was that the greatest abuse of power was not for self-interest, but the greatest abuse of power was the abandonment of it. Mm. People are just too afraid, too anxious, too insecure about exercising the power that came with their influence and their role, and so not using it at all. And so, you know, what's always amazing is to watch CEOs of big companies tell me how powerless they feel, how unable to influence change they feel, how much their voice doesn't matter. And there are truths about the political nature of being in big jobs, right? Your influence is not absolute. But it's also stunning to see how many leaders, how many consultants, how many thought leaders don't use even the basic important levels of influence and power available to them in the network of relationships that they have, in the positions they hold, and in the information they can share. We have those three sources of power available to us all the time. And if we know how to use them well, and presuming that we desire to do something good with them, the data suggests that those that set themselves apart and thrived in positions of influence knew how to use their influence well, knew how to think about the success of others, knew how to help others develop and grow, knew how to be generous with sharing information and access to information, and knew how to right wrongs, right? So every community, every organization, every university has something unjust about it, some process that's unfair, perceived to be unfair, or some decision right that's in the wrong place. And leaders don't appreciate that they have the ability to make just what feels unjust. And leaders who focus on those things, leaders who set out to and understand that their position of leadership isn't for them, to your point before, it's not about you. It's about those you serve. And when you make your position of influence about those you serve, your power is amplified and your credibility is bolstered and your impact is lasting. But it's not easy. It does cost. And those leaders that don't want to pay the cost or are too afraid to be disruptive or be unpopular or, you know, risk the estrangement of those they're leading tend to sort of sit back and say yes to everybody and smile nicely and make everybody happy. And they win a lot of popularity, but they don't necessarily win a lot of respect.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, I mean, as you're describing that, I was thinking, well, it's even worse than the abandonment of power. Maybe abandonment of power is the right term, but it's worse than having no influence, because they are having an influence, but it's a kind of a negative influence, isn't it?
Well, it's a great point, Jürgen. What they're saying is doing nothing is okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's playing it safe, being politic, currying favor, buying people's loyalty with favors. You're defining what leadership is. Your bad habits are setting a tone, and people will take the cues from you. They will follow your lead. And so you can create a very large organization, a very complacent, risk averse, not truth telling, people, because they'll assume that if that's what you're doing, that must be what you want from them.
Yeah. So, in terms of developing emerging leaders, what are some of the key things that people businesses need to take into account? Because, I mean, one of the things that I'm always fascinated by is, you know, whether a company, I mean, a lot of businesses I work with are growing companies, and then they start to hire more and more people, and then the issue becomes, well, how do we develop those people? How do we train them? And I'm always fascinated that there's no longer-term plan which says that, well, when can I walk away from this? When can I hand it over to somebody else? And who's there to step up to this, and how do we develop them?
Yeah, I think I wish that people would think about developing people they hired. So often, especially in the startup phases, they're just hiring bodies and by the droves. You know, it's almost like if you can produce breath on a mirror and fog it, you're in.
Yeah.
And then you have startup leaders having to layer over people they've started with them, and no sense for how to organize the work of people, and no sense for how to optimize their contribution at all. And so I think, depending on where you are in your level of maturity, you know, in the startup or growth or, you know, reinvention phases, preparing people for the future, preparing people for broader assignments, preparing people to take on greater influence is so critical from the earliest stages of your organization and from the earliest stages of their career. That's one of the things that was exciting in our research, was that while we discovered so many unnecessary landmines that organizations put in the way of leaders who are trying to rise up and be more influential, we did isolate the things that those leaders that were sticking the landing, those leaders that were arriving in bigger jobs and thriving, there were four very consistent patterns of what they did to be impacting. They knew the broader organization. They knew how the pieces fit together. They could read context. They didn't just slap on answers mindlessly, but they asked questions, and they were curious, and they adapted their own ideas and approaches to fit the context. They could make hard choices. They could say no. They could narrow the focus of the organization and help make hard decisions in order to keep the organization thriving, even if that meant foregoing good ideas. And they built great relationships. They had deep connections of trust and credibility with those they led, with their peers, and with their bosses. And they focused especially on how to make other people successful. They went out of the way to find ways to put the needs and the priorities of others on their agenda. And those are four really hard things to do. And what was particularly difficult about the study is that the ones that set themselves apart did all four well. So if you did three of the four well, you still end up in the failure group. But they can be learned. To your question, they can be learned. They shouldn't be learned at your first vice president assignment. a little bit late then.
Yeah.
But even at your entry-level positions, you can learn the broader organization. You can learn to be contextually intelligent. You can learn to build great relationships. And you can learn to participate in decision-making and prioritization and focus. If you build those four muscles on your way up, when you get to broader levels of assignment, you'll be ready for them.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. I made that note. I actually wrote down five. So what were the four?
So
big picture.
Breadth.
Yeah.
The wider organization. Context, you know, depth of specifics of your industry and money and what's happening around you. Choice, making hard decisions and trails. And connection, relationships.
Okay. So the making other people successful was part of the relationships.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Well, in fact, it was the basis of the relationships.
Yeah, that's right. Good point. And I think a lot of, I know thinking back into my career, certainly my first corporate job, I don't know how I lasted that long there. Boss I was working for definitely didn't have that fourth point. He was all about making himself look good, and even at the expense of making people in his own team unsuccessful.
Yeah, and I mean, they cause a lot of damage. They're the ones that typically, at some point, they fall off the pedestal hard, and often it's unrecoverable. But the reality is that, you know, it's so naturally when you get somebody who's even good people and they get their first larger job, and you ask them to begin to map their stakeholders, their first inclination is to begin listing off people they need something from, not people who rely on them to whom they have to contribute. And getting them to flip that mindset to, yes, you have to cultivate relationship and stay in good trust stead with those from whom you rely on, but you equally have to tend and invest aggressively in relationships with people you can contribute to even more so.
Yeah. Great advice.
And to your point, if you're like your old boss, you have no predisposition to care about other people's success, or you're threatened by their success, assuming that it makes you look worse, you may have some flash in the pan success. You may, you know, get a couple of good years of bonuses and the like, but at some point you will get found out. And that's usually a very ugly moment. and often not recoverable.
Yeah. All right. So one of the other things that I know you talk about and you've published blog posts about is the question of developing the younger generation, the millennial generation. And I know, you know, there's a lot of people I've spoken to in companies that find it challenging. There seems to be this, I don't know, generation gap, and some of the stereotypes of the millennials don't have a long attention span. They're always on their phone and they're always jumping in and out of the social media where, you know, 144 characters, or I think it's 288 now, but so that's the length of their attention span, and they're not loyal because they've got so many opportunities. They job hop and all this kind of stuff. So what's some of your advice to develop millennials as future leaders and to win their loyalty and, to work with them successfully?
You know, it's about 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Leadership Divided, and it was about emerging leaders. It was before we had the term millennials. We had a label for them, but it was about their, you know, their very vivid appearance onto the scene of the workplace and how different they seemed and how to build a relationship with them. And people were so fixated on labeling them and getting their demographic difference, and as if the year you were born really had much to do with anything.
Yeah.
And our research, we talked to 3,400 of them in that research, and made a plea for the world to understand this is not a problem of demographics. This is not about the year you were born. This is a problem of relationship. It's a problem of connection. And we so often apply, broad brush labels like entitled, lazy, ungrateful, disloyal, want rewards immediately. But those five terms, entitled, lazy, ungrateful, disloyal, want rewards immediately, opened up a 1968 Life magazine article about boomers. So the truth of the matter is we're not so different than past generations. I think what is significantly different is that, you know, back then we boomers had two options, opt in or opt out. And we were still paying the price of those that opted out. Right.
Yeah.
But this generation has way more options. They can just create their own options. So yes, that is a different level of complexity, but they are honestly one of the most social justice minded, giving, committed generations. That yes, they're neurotic about their own standards, not because they want advancement, because this was a generation we told you will change the world, and it turns out they believed us. And now we need to get out of their way and help them do it. Sometimes they're not ready, and they think they are, and so they don't fear letting us down. They fear letting themselves down, and sometimes that's a little bit hard for us to take, but for us to understand. But I tell you, this generation can take hard, blunt feedback better than any other generation I've ever worked with. I sit across from my peers and I say one piece of rough feedback and they fall apart. you give hard feedback to a millennial, they can't get enough of it. They just want to go improve. Yeah. They are far more thick-skinned than their predecessors. And so they're extraordinarily talented people who deserve our investment, who deserve, they're the largest population in the workplace right now. Mm. And rather than resisting or labeling them or being annoyed or irritated by them, we should remember that people were irritated by us.
Yeah, that's right.
And our job is to come alongside them and help them be successful. Sometimes that means shutting up. Sometimes it means pushing back on them and saying, you're not ready for that opportunity, and here's how you get ready for it. Hmm. And not trying to, quarantine them in some way. And a lot of times, yes, the relationship is reversed, where you have boomers reporting to them, and it looks weird, and it feels like they're not ready to lead me, why should I have to report to them? We'll get over it.
Down
with them and say, okay, how's this going to go? What is it I can offer you? There's probably something I can offer you. And what can you offer me? And negotiate the relationship like you would with any boss. And don't be dismissive of their age or what you perceive to be a lack of experience. Hmm. Just help them be successful.
Yeah. Help them be successful. Yeah. Make other people successful. That's really fabulous advice. And you said a couple of things there that I think are quite important. I never really actually thought of that, but we did, we've all told young people, millennials, if you like, as they were growing up, I remember telling my children, you're going to change the world. So, yeah, so now they are. And so we should either help them do that or get out of the way.
If you look around, the world isn't short of our need of change, right? It's not like we...
There's a few things to address.
At the core of the problem, Jürgen, is what we call the war between legacy and potential, right? Where my legacy feels threatened by your potential, and vice versa, my potential feels threatened by your legacy. You don't want to get out of the way. The reality is, boomers, those of us who are the incumbent leaders, fear obsolescence, and millennials fear being muted. And the beauty of that is that outside my legacy, your potential can't be reached. And outside of your potential, I have no legacy. So it's quite a beautifully complementary set of needs. And why we participate in a relationship as if they're at odds, it's a zero-sum game, I don't know. If we could just simply flip their equation and realize that their potential and our legacy have wonders to do together, we could just get on with it.
Yeah, that's wonderfully put. It's wonderfully put. And I think, at the core of the needs, it both comes back to, in both cases, of significance and making a contribution, leaving the world a better place than when you came into it. So, that it seems to be that the purpose is the same in both cases.
And if we could just allow those purposes to coexist in complementary ways, we can all do great things together. The millennials are certainly willing. They may not always look like it, and they may not always know how to express it effectively, but that's how we can help them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've had the privilege of speaking to a number of quite amazing young people in under 30 recently on the podcast that have done some amazing things. And I also follow some people and consider them mentors, actually, that I learned from that. I remember on one occasion, I didn't actually credit this person with being that young. He does look a little older. I won't name him. when I found out his age, and he definitely is in that millennial generation, but I thought, that surprised me, but it doesn't make any difference how I feel about his value that he's adding to me.
Well, the reality is that the question I asked in Leadership Divided was, it's not which are you. Mm. It's which are you when? Because the reality is there are days I'm the millennial.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right. That's really fascinating. So the other thing that struck me and I think it was in the same TED Talk that I referred to earlier, is how to build that relationship and in terms of talking to somebody about the influence that they can have. And it was the question, ask for their story. So explain that to us a bit more, because I thought that was so powerful.
Yeah, it was a school teacher I tell the story of. And it's just one of the most under-leveraged. So one of the, in Leadership Divided, one of the, in that book, one of the things, one of the six dimensions that set aside great cross-generational relationships was an ongoing display of gratitude. The power of gratitude, especially to millennials, it's a very important value. And, you know, and we so often confuse compliments and praise, right? And we give compliments, and you know, we've all had the experience, right? If I give you a compliment, you feel insulted. Hmm. And we've all had compliments backfire, because the truth of the matter is the compliment payer really has no idea what it was they're complimenting. And they don't, they're just sort of checking off their I praised you box. And to many on the receiving end, it just feels cheap and obligatory and not meaningful. And one of the most under-leveraged sources of incredible gratitude leaders have available to them is that question. Tell me how you did it. They, behind every contribution is an story. And we have to understand that somebody's contribution is an extension of who they are. It's an expression of their identity. It's not just the thing they did and handed in. And sitting and listening interestingly, you know, with passion to how they, tell me how you accomplished it. How'd you get here? And this one school teacher, he was a junior high school teacher, right? We all know junior hires are not the easiest to motivate. But the grades in his classes were higher than any place else. Attendance, participation, performance was just much higher across all of his middle school grades. And one of his secrets was, I asked for the story. And he said, as I asked them about when a project or a paper or something they'd done, as they began telling the story and where they struggled and where they had breakthroughs and where they learned something and where they learned something together and where they got it done, they became animated. They became invested. And the more intently I listened and the more the questions I asked and the more engaged I was, the more validated they felt and the more invested they felt. And I think, you know, tell me how you did it is one of the greatest sources of gratitude, to say, I care enough to know about the accomplishment so that I've earned my right to say thank you for it.
Yeah, I think that is such a powerful technique and really great piece of advice. So thanks for explaining that some more. So I think, you know, this is a fascinating discussion. I could go on for hours, but I respect your time. So I think it's time we moved on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. It's designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some more. You've already given us great insightful answers, but some more insightful answers that will help inspire people to go and do something awesome and be more influential. So what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
I think part of it is training your eyes to see what you're not, you know, to see what you don't expect to see, to know, you know, where is the thing right in front of you you're not recognizing. Ask different questions, ask what if, ask why not. But most of our eyes are trained to see what we're trained to see. And so start from the posture of I don't know versus I already know, and train your eyes to recognize things that are right in front of you that you're predisposed to sort of edit out of the picture.
Yeah, that's great advice. So be really curious, but also train yourself to see things that you often overlook. So see the trees in the forest.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas and products?
Hired a coach. I think, you know, help is such a beautiful thing. I mean, interestingly, the word creativity comes from the Latin derivative it's a social experience. It's not a cognitive one. You know, being creative is something that's meant to happen in community. It's not meant to happen off in a lab by ourselves. And so having the friction of sparked thoughts and provocative ideas and challenging assumptions in community, in relationship, has pushed me to the best thinking I've ever done. I don't have my best ideas by myself.
That's great advice, and particularly around the business coach, who, you know, a good business coach will challenge you and will help you see what you don't see, and ask the right questions too.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have a favorite tool or a system for improving your own productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
So a couple, in the spirit of, you know, this is about community and relationships. So the one we're on right now, Zoom, I have found to be, you know, we're a virtual firm. And so we don't, none of us are in the same office. I mean, we have, some of us are in the same city and we use the same office, but for the most part, we're virtual. And since we began using Zoom, where we can see each other's faces and, talk to each other and, connect more intimately, the conversation's changed. The ideation has changed. The ability to co-create is now different. So I've loved this tool. And I'm, you know, part of the way I keep my life organized is I use Outlook. I use Outlook far more than just as an email or calendar tool. It's a filing system. It's a sorting tool. It's a notes-taking system. But it keeps my life moving forward. It's a travel. It's a travel management system.
Yeah.
It's a hotel management system. It's got a lot of great productivity elements to it.
Mm. All right, great advice. So Outlook, I haven't used Outlook for some time, but I'm sure it's come a long way since I changed out of that. But yeah, the important thing is kind of having a central area where you manage all the things, and I think that you've made that point there. And I love Zoom because, as you say, the ability to see people's faces. I mean, we're doing an audio cast now, but we did look into each other's eyes early, and I also have a remote team, so that really is valuable because we get on Zoom at least 3 or 4 times a week just to review what we're doing, and the ability to actually see faces and use that to build the relationships is invaluable. Okay, what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
Feedback. You have to constantly be asking the question, how am I doing? How are we doing? How's this doing? You've got to have metrics. You've got to have data sources. Too often, you know, our engagements just are move on autopilot, or there's misassumptions. And then when things go sideways, it's because you never, you know, some detour was taken weeks or months ago and no one knew. And so, you know, constantly checking in on the relationship, constantly checking in on progress, constantly making sure you're bringing feedback, even if it's not good news to your client. They have got to learn to trust us as truth brokers, as people who will tell them what others won't. And so the constant exchange of data and feedback is so critical.
Great advice. Yeah. And it's consistent with the whole principle of communication and building relationships, isn't it?
Well, it's too often that we think, you know, we signed a contract or we signed a letter of agreement. We, you know, here's my deliverables. Here's the fee you pay. I go off and do my work and I bring back a finished product. And of course, the danger there is that it's my finished product, not yours. And my job is not to bring you answers like those Andy Blue Blinders we talked about earlier. My job is to make sure you can do this on your own next time without me.
Yeah.
So if I'm not transferring that knowledge, if what we're discovering is not being discovered with you and your people, then I'm not really adding the most value I can. I'm just a hired pair of hands.
Yeah. All right. Now, we spoke earlier about the amount of noise, I guess, on the internet and how people are doing things in a certain way. What's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
The interesting thing about self-promotion is that there's lots of ways. I have actually, one of my Forbes pieces is, you know, how to self-promote without, you know, having it backfire, because you can get misjudged, mislabeled, misunderstood so easily, especially when you're being interpreted through so many other lenses on the internet. But I do think that, you used the word before, it's consistency and clarity. You've got to know what it is that does set you apart, right? Just trying to be noticed isn't isn't helpful, right? Getting watched versus getting seen shouldn't be the goal, right? You have to be seen and known and understood, which means you have to be real clear about what are the insights, what's the contribution you can make that others really want. And so matching a real clear sense of what you want to contribute with a set of people you know need it, and being, you know, really diligent about keeping on that plumb line and not deviating from it. Too many people flit between, you know, the fad du jour or the content du jour or the idea du jour, and then they have a lot of stuff out there, but people still can't tell who it is you are, what you stand for.
Mm, great advice.
And consistency and clarity.
Yeah, love it. All right, so what's the future then for Navalent? I noticed you've got a Leading Through Turbulence virtual summit coming up. You might want to tell us about that.
Yeah, very exciting. So this is our, you know, our continuation of our journey to learn to curate great content. And what leader isn't leading through turbulent times? But we're very excited. March 3rd through 9th, or 5th through 9th, we're hosting some amazing thought leaders, Dan Pink and Dori Clark and Nilufer Merchant and Whitney Johnson and John Haidt and Mark Crowley and CEOs of big companies and small companies. 25 amazing thought leaders and organization leaders who've been through turbulent times and how they've done it. And so please come to the website or put the link on your show notes and sign up for an amazing set of conversations. It's exciting content. We've got a great participants guide. There's a free ebook on leading transformation. There's a complimentary version for the week that the summit happens. There's a very, very economical version for a whole year of curated content, curated conversation, you know, private coaching calls with us. You know, for $300, you can get a whole year of access to some amazing content. So I do hope your listeners will check it out and join us. Mm.
Yep. Well, we'll definitely have the link in the show notes for that. And I think the publishing schedule probably puts us just about a week or two before that. So that timing will be good. So, so what else is on the horizon for Navalent?
So, you know, we have some wonderful new products and clients beginning this year. I think that we have a couple of new endeavors. So coming out of the virtual summit, your folks will hear about a new cohort called Rising Together. And so we, you know, in the spirit of how do we find great future leaders to work with versus the sociopaths, we decided let's make our own. And so we have a new offering, you know, for those in the middle of organizations looking to rise up and become part of a global virtual community of people being developed and cared for and invested in. And so we'll be launching that later this year. Our 10-year study, our 10 years of data and 2,700 interviews has actually now become 15 years of data and 3,400 interviews. And so in the last study for Rising to Power, we isolated individual behavior. And so we're going to go back in that basket and see what's in there and see sniff around what might the rest of the organization be telling us besides individual behavior that's happening to set great organizations apart from the ones that are struggling. So hopefully that's going to begin this year as well.
Mm, sounds fascinating. Look forward to both of those. So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business that wants to be a leader in innovation and in their field?
You know, it's a piece of advice, Jürgen, that my mentor, for the last 30 years, gave me many, many years ago. She said, nothing in life is irrevocable except death. You get do-overs. You get other chances. And so sometimes the self-limiting excuses, the self-limiting reasons we justify not trying or pulling our punches or being overly cautious and not really reaching for an aspiration or an ambition sell our results short. They sell our outcomes short. And so I think if I had learned earlier on not to care as much about what other people thought as I did, not to fear what would happen if I made a mistake or what other people would think of me if I didn't reach a goal I set, I would have reached much further, much sooner. So I think if we can remember that, You know, yeah, there are occasions in life where you don't get do-overs. But for the most part, and when it comes to work life, you do. And I'd rather see people reach further and skin their knees than reach for what's easy and comfortable and, you know, mark time.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. My business coach has a saying, and I think I might have thrown it in the conversation already, and it's get over yourself. So anytime I have some sort of hesitation that's based on a limiting belief and I don't do what I basically know is the right thing to do, but because I'm worried about something, her response usually is just get over yourself.
Yep.
And do it, yeah. Which yep. is essentially don't worry about what other people think or don't worry about something that's inconsequential. All right. Well, thanks, Ron. This has been really fabulous. Where can people reach out and say thank you for what you've shared with us today?
Oh, my gosh. I'd love to keep the invitation of the conversation going with your listeners. Navalent.com, N-A-V-A-L-E-N-T, is where I hang out a lot. We've got some great content. We've got a quarterly magazine on all these topics on leadership and organization and teams and self-awareness and personal development. We have a free ebook on leading transformation. Folks can also get if they don't sign up for the summit, and that's at navalent.com/transformation. I'm on Twitter at Ron Carucci, and I'm on LinkedIn. So would love to hang out with folks and keep chatting.
All right. We'll have all those links along with the others in the show notes. So finally, Ron, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
Oh, my gosh. if you haven't already interviewed Kim Scott, she's fabulous, and I think your guests would love her. And she wrote the book Radical Candor.
No, I haven't interviewed her yet.
Really great woman, great interview. She's appearing in our virtual summit, but she's sharp, she's funny, she's witty, she's thoughtful. And I think in this notion of finding our voice and standing apart, she really has some great insights about, you know, how to make sure our voice is being truthful and honest and caring.
Wonderful. Thanks for that suggestion. So, Kim, if you're listening, keep an eye on your inbox. We'll reach out to you to get you on the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Ron Carucci. So thanks for sharing your time and your insights so generously with us on the InnovaBuzz podcast today, Ron. I've really enjoyed this. It's been a lot of interesting and really insightful information. I could go on for ages, but we might have to have you back on the podcast sometime.
I welcome the chance to keep chatting, Jürgen. Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So I wish you all the best for the future of Navalent and for the upcoming summit, and let's keep in touch.
Thanks, Jürgen. You bet.
I really love talking with Ron and hearing his advice and insights. I hope you did too. I particularly loved his succinct summary of the four key attributes of a great leader. All the ideas and tips that Ron shared with us can be found at innovabiz.co/Ron Carucci. That is RONCARUCCI. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Ron Carucci. Now, just a reminder, that is innovabiz.co. Now, you'll find contact information for getting in touch with Ron there, as well as links to his website, to his books, and the other things that we spoke about on the interview. Ron suggested I interview Kim Scott of Radical Candor on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So Kim, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Ron Carucci of Navalent. If you haven't already done so, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Cast, your favorite podcast app, and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so that you'll never miss a future episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because we always welcome feedback, and reviews let us know how we're doing, and they also help get us found by more people and get the message of our wonderful guests out to a bigger audience. If there's anything you'd like us to cover or questions you want answered on a future InnovaBuzz podcast or guests you'd like us to interview, please send those ideas to us as well. Finally, Another quick reminder about our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. No cost to join. Just go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. Hope to see you there soon. And when you first join, please do introduce yourself to the group. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.